Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, David Onick. For the next hour, we will dive into one of San Francisco's most contentious ballot measures this election cycle, Proposition G. Known as the anti-speculation tax, Prop G has urgent support and robust opposition, reflecting ongoing tension about the high cost of housing in San Francisco. Would Prop G make San Francisco more affordable? Is it an effective deterrent to real estate speculation, or is it a major new tax on well-meaning property owners? We have both sides at the table tonight making their case. Joining me in studio are Jay Cheng, Head of Government Affairs at the San Francisco Association of Realtors. Welcome, Jay.
Thank you for having us today.
And Peter Cohen, Co-Director of the San Francisco Council of Community Housing Organizations. Welcome, Peter.
Thanks very much, David.
And by phone, we have Professor Larry Rosenthal, an assistant adjunct professor at the Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Welcome, Larry.
Hello, David. Great to be with you.
Later in the program, we'll be asking you, our listeners, to call in and join our conversation. You can text or email a question right now at cityvisions@kalw.org, or you can post a comment on our website at kalw.org. Larry, from the Goldman School, let me start with you. Can you tell our listeners what Prop G actually consists of?
Well, it's a graduated tax on land and improvements transfers in the residential sector. It will affect properties that are at least 2 units and up to 30 units. And it represents a very aggressive form of taxation on activity, which really represents rapid turnover in the market, and which seeks to gain advantage through the rapid increase in prices.
And can you put this in historical context for us a little bit? Obviously, housing is by almost any measure the number one issue in San Francisco right now. Has this come on recently? Is this something that has been thought about for years? What's the context for us?
Well, I think, you know, when we set it in the appropriate context, Proposition G represents the desire of San Franciscans to address really worrisome problems, which is part of living in San Francisco, that there will never be any shortage of people who want to buy, invest, and move to San Francisco. The problem is by no means new. We, in fact, did some historical digging and found an early reference to a San Francisco affordability crisis, and that was in the Chronicle in the 1950s. So, in fact, this affordability challenge is a part of the way of life of San Francisco, and Proposition G is just one of many attempts to get after activities in the marketplace that help some but may also injure many others.
You talked about it being a graduated tax. Can you talk about what the tax levels are what the different levels are and what the different percent taxes are at each of those levels?
I'd leave it to Jay to I think he's probably much more fluent, but I know that if a property transacts within 1 year of purchase, that against the basis of the purchase price, the value paid on the second sale, that fully 24% of that price will be forfeited by the purchaser and will have to be paid into the city's general fund. So on a $2 million property, that means nearly $500,000 will be transferred out of that value to the city. It's substantial. As far as the graduation, Jay, I guess it goes down to, in year five, down to something in the 20% range?
That's right. It starts at 24% the first year, then 20% the second year, 18% the third year, and from 4 to 5, it goes down to 14%. Ends year five at 14% of the total sales price.
Okay, thanks, Jay. And Larry, you said it went to the city of San Francisco. Is this going into the general fund or is it going to a specific purpose?
It's going to the general fund, and that actually has been one of the points of contention in the early debates on putting this matter on the ballot. And now, as we're evaluating its merits, or at least San Francisco voters are doing so, that there are some arguments that a stronger proposal would be to earmark the proceeds of the surtax and ensure that every penny of them gets spent on affordable housing development. I think that it's largely a matter of political necessity if you're in favor of Prop G and expediency if you're against it. It turns out, I think, that that kind of earmark would have required a two-thirds proportion of the voters in favor of Prop G. And I don't think the proponents are were certain at the time that they could get to two-thirds. But beyond that, I think the merits of earmarking probably are one thing that everyone can agree upon. If we're doing this for purposes of boosting affordability, it's in everyone's interest that the proceeds of the Proposition G surtax be devoted towards that cause.
Okay, Larry, really appreciate that background. Peter Cohen from the San Francisco Council of Community Housing Organizations, you and your organization are supporters of Prop G. Why should our listeners vote for it?
Well, thanks, David. And, you know, Larry said it's a worrisome problem and it's not a new problem. And I think I don't have to tell most of your listeners that we're in one of the worst affordability crises now than that anybody has seen in recent history. I mean, the price of a rental unit is astronomical. I think the latest Jay might know is $3,500 plus for a two-bedroom apartment. Homes have reached $1 million on average. So the stress of being able to get into San Francisco and stay in San Francisco is tremendous. And part of the collateral damage, very unfortunately and sadly, of a hot real estate market is evictions. And we've seen thousands of people lose their homes in a time when we have great economic prosperity, which everybody loves, but to recognize that real estate speculation is a business and it takes advantage of, it profits on that hot economic time, and we have been losing people and losing some of that rental housing. So Proposition G is, as Larry said, a step towards doing something about this marketplace behavior and using, you know, the old way of putting a very stiff surtax on the types of activities that you're trying to discourage to encourage the inverse, which is long-term investments in our property, in our neighborhoods, and to stabilize our communities rather than destabilize. Yeah.
Okay, Jay. And Jay, again, is Jay Chang, with the head of government affairs at the San Francisco Association of Realtors, which, along with the California Association of Realtors and the National Association of Realtors, is opposing this measure. Jay, why should our listeners vote no?
For us, that's very simple, David. And that's that this is a 14 to 24% tax on the entire sales price of a property when sold within 5 years of ownership. And when we think about what that means, we think about that this tax will apply to all buildings with between 2 to 30 units in San Francisco. That's over 70% of our multi-unit building stock. Now, we're a unique city. We're not like San Jose, and we're not even like Oakland in this way, that the majority of our buildings are multi-unit buildings. So you think about the duplexes and the Sunset, three-unit buildings you find on Irving or Clement, and the owners of these properties are middle-class homeowners. And in San Francisco, this has been the traditional kind of middle-class homeownership model. It also applies to all single-family homes with the in-law unit. And in San Francisco, that's 50,000 single-family homes in San Francisco. Over one-third of all single-family homes have an in-law unit in it, and it would be fall under this tax. Now, the assessor recorder in 2013 said the average home turns over every 7 years, and this tax would hit you if you sold within 5 years of ownership. And the city controller says in his economic analysis that the tax on the average home would have been $413,000. If applied over the last 8 years. So we are talking about, as Larry mentioned, we are talking about a massive tax that will impact middle-class homeowners who own these buildings. Now, we're the first to recognize that evictions and the rising housing prices, right, are breaking our San Francisco housing market.
So what would you suggest be done if not this proposition?
Sure. We see a number of different housing solutions, and I know Peter's championed a number of them that we actually support. One of the good examples is Mayor Ed Lee's acquisition and rehab program, which says if you have a building on the market and you're afraid that it's vulnerable to eviction and you have tenants living in there who are rent controlled, that the city should step in as a buyer and purchase the building from the property owner at full price, and then sign the tenants in there for 200-year leases, keeping them at permanent affordable housing. It creates permanently affordable housing very quickly. It's an elegant solution. And the property owner, many of which are seniors, feel like they've walked away with their retirement nest eggs intact. I think it's a very elegant solution that will actually reduces the number of evictions you see each year, because each building you purchase, right, the number of evictions, you're chipping away at it. Now, the fund's only $3 million large, which is tiny for in San Francisco's housing market. But we would love to see that fund expanded. And for us, we support that program. We've mentioned to the mayor that we support that program. I know Peter has worked a long time on that program.
Well, let me come over to you, Peter. Are you in agreement on that? And why do you think that is not sufficient for the crisis we're facing right now?
Well, it's heartening for me to hear Jay talking about what we call the Small Sites Acquisition Rehab Program, since Choo Choo, my organization, worked for the last 5 years to create that, and we're very excited about its launch. So, yes, that's an opportunity for us to be able to take some of these small rental buildings off the speculation market, put them into permanently affordable housing. That's a solution, but that in and of itself is not going to stop the speculation behavior. It's interesting that Jay mentions that, because one opportunity that's built into Proposition G is that for those real estate speculators that do buy and then want to quickly resell a building, they can sell it to an entity that wants to put it into permanently affordable housing, and the tax is exempt. So that is a way to encourage that kind of small site ACT rehab that Jay's talking about, by virtue of giving a speculator an option if that's what they want to do. I also want to get back to a comment that Jay made. You know, we're going to play with numbers, I'm sure, on this show. If you read the controller's statement, not only did it say that there would be an average of $400,000 of a surtax on properties looking back, but also that it would be an average of 60 buildings a year. 60. That's it. It's a very narrowly targeted surtax on those kinds of rental properties that are turned over very quickly. So it might sound like a big number in terms of the tax amount, but it's not on, as he called it, the average home. It's on a small number of rental property buildings that would be turned over in every year. And that's, mind you, before the discouragement in the first place of having that tax in our face. So if we're thinking about the universe of how this applies and who it applies to, we're talking about professional real estate investors who typically take advantage of these hot markets.
Jay, let me come back to you and ask what other solutions, because I know you had more than one that you were going to list, that you would see if our voters care about this issue but don't believe that this is a that they should vote yes on this particular proposition. What are you suggesting some other solutions are?
Sure, absolutely. And one of the other solutions, and I think Peter and I both agree on this, although we would probably play with the numbers again on this, but it's simply building more housing. And that's the core of our problem right now, is that we live in a closed housing market, and supply and demand rules do apply. And when you reduce the supply of housing, right, and keep the demand where it is, then you're going to have increased housing prices. And for us, what Proposition G, and just to bring it very quickly back to Proposition G, what Proposition G represents is a decreased supply of rental housing, because you're taking single-family homeowners who have in-law units, and 50,000 of them in San Francisco, and you're saying, if you have an in-law unit, you might be taxed by Prop G. But if you take the in-law unit out of your home, take out that renter from your home, you will be exempt, right? Because single-family homes are exempt from Prop G. So what you're giving single-family homeowners, those property owners, is an incentive to remove their rental unit from the market, so they can avoid Proposition G. And for us, this is a huge issue built into the program, right? When we want to talk about solving the housing market, we need to talk about increasing the supply and not limiting it and then punishing it through various forms such as Proposition G.
Peter, I want to give you a chance to respond to that. Do you think it would have that effect on people with in-law units? And also, it's two units and above. Was there any thought, just to get rid of that argument, whether it's valid or not, to make it three units and above?
No, it's about multifamily housing, and it's about housing where there's rental units. I disagree with Jay. The exemption is very clear on single-family homes. Now, we have the estimates are somewhere between 30 and 40 or 1,000 or so homes with illegal in-law units. And right now, those are single-family homes. So an illegal in-law unit that's in a property that's not treated as a duplex or a two-unit building, and the same thing if it's sold and it's still not been legalized, it's still sold as a single-family home. If that is actually legalized through the new process the city just established this year, that becomes a new residential unit, which if you read into the ordinance, it actually provides an exemption for new residential units being constructed. Or in the other case, with the ordinance that was passed specifically for the Castro to literally build and add an in-law unit, that also is considered a new residential unit. So to Jay's point, we're actually very purposely trying to encourage new supply, which is also including legalization of existing illegal in-laws and creation of new, and actually expanding buildings by adding more units or just overall building supply. Look, Choo Choo's in the business of production. That's what we want to focus on. The reality, though, is we lose hundreds of units because they are taken off of the market from rental, and they are typically sold as condos. And if we're going to get ahead of the curve on meeting our housing supply, we need to preserve what we already have and all focus together on adding new supply. That's one of the things that Prop G does, is try to preserve the existing rental housing we have rather than putting people out on the streets. And the reality is probably out of San Francisco.
Okay, we're going to take a short break, and then we'll continue the conversation. You're listening to City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KLW San Francisco, and on the web at klw.org. Tonight, we're discussing San Francisco's Proposition G with our guests, Peter Cohen, co-director of the San Francisco Council of Community Housing Organizations, Jay Cheng, head of government affairs at the San Francisco Association of Realtors, and Professor Larry Rosenthal of the University of California, Berkeley. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. Where do you stand on Proposition G? Do you feel this is a solution to our city's housing costs? The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also text us or email us at cityvisions@klw.org or post a comment on the KALW website. We have talked some about who is exempt and who isn't. And a question I have for you, Peter, is we talked about on the low end that it's two and up. Why are owners of 30 or more units exempt from this proposition? Some people would say it's some kind of backroom deal to get so the really big developers don't pour in money against this. It sounds like that's happening anyway. So what is the policy rationale for exempting buildings that are 30 or more units?
Sure. Well, it's very data driven. When you actually look at where there has been eviction activity in multi-unit apartment buildings, you're seeing that it's happening at the low end, and you know, sort of the 2 and 3 units, the low end, and really once you get above maybe the 20-25 units, close to 30, you're not seeing that kind of quick flipping of activity. There are different kinds of investors in the market. There's different kinds of landlords. There's different sorts of economic motivations for buying and holding rental property. And when you get into larger buildings, you don't see typically an investor coming in, buying a 50-unit apartment building and turning around in 3 years and selling it. That's not the kind of thing you're having. They're more long-term holders of that property. So the problem, if you will, which we're trying to address, which is to discourage that flipping of property and typically the eviction of folks in the process, is in that small and mid-sized building. So, again, like many other things, Prop G is tailored and has a real target in mind, and that's why it's designed the way it is. I mean, I could easily see that if we'd done something that was more broad sweeping, we'd be critiqued for having a broad and kind of sloppy net. This is intended to zero in on the target.
So you'd be criticized either way.
You'd be criticized either way. I'm sure Jay would be criticizing no matter what we did. That's his business.
Since it's my business, I think for us, when we talk about political expediency, we actually look to a different exemption in the legislation. And the exemption I look towards is Exemption 7, which says that if you pulled a building permit before July 1st, and you have a 2-unit building and your total construction cost was $500,000, you're exempt from Proposition G. And I, for one, cannot see any policy rationale for this exemption, except for the fact that it exempted exactly 25 buildings in the city that were all owned by a group, a very influential political group, Residential Builders Association, that were all currently being in construction and would have been hit by Prop G. And this is an exemption that is a direct carve-out for a specific political group, so they could stay out of the Prop G debate. And I think when we look at the reasons why it goes to the general fund, so it can only have 50% passage, when we look at the reasons why buildings over 30 are exempt, and when we look at reasons why buildings with building permits before July 1st are pulled and carved out, we look at multiple examples of why this is a political expedient move and has no policy rationale for it.
Well, I want to give Peter a chance to respond, but Jay, a question for you. You know, what if all those exemptions, what if none of that was in there? Would you then support this?
You know, I think that's a really interesting question. We would have loved to be brought to the table around Proposition G and sat down and really talked about what was possible and what couldn't be
possible. What's in there now that you could support?
What's in there now that we could support? Well, I think for Proposition G, we love that single-family homes was exempt right? We heard that until a week beforehand, single-family homes were not exempt, right? But then again, that exemption is knocked out because single-family homes with in-laws are not exempt, right? We love that if the record owner passes, then the property is exempt from the tax for 1 year. It's unfortunate because the average probate is 2 years long. And that means the majority of people who are inheriting the property will never get to see that benefit. And so we have a list of exemptions here that theoretically we would have supported, but are so poorly crafted and so outside of what actual real estate practice is, right? For instance, an average probate that's 2 years long, but your exemption only lasts 1 year, that doesn't make sense. They don't make sense for the average homeowner. And so there's no way we could have supported that. But we would have loved to sit down and talked about it. The day we heard this legislation, which we were told of the day the legislation was introduced, we called Supervisor Eric Morrow's office. We said, can we sit down and talk about amendments? And we were told absolutely not. And the amendment we put on the table was, can you exempt sale to a family member? Just exempt sale to a family member. I'm Chinese American. It happens all the time in my community. A father buys a property for his son to pass it on, and it happens usually less than 5 years. Can you exempt sale to a family member? Clearly not speculation. Clearly just a normal sale. And they said absolutely not. And so we were not even brought to the table about this, but we would love to talk about it.
Okay, Peter, our phones are lighting up, so I want to get to our callers. But Peter, first, I want to give you an opportunity to respond to some of the claims about why exemptions were picked whether there's a rationale for them. So please, this is your time to respond.
Okay. Well, again, you know, the idea is to zero in on the target of where the problems are happening and looking forward. And, you know, what we see is we see multi-unit buildings, and I just disagree with Jay on this whole in-law issue. I think it's something they've been fishing for a long time. We're talking about properties where there are rental units, and between 2 and 30 units is where we have seen from historical data that the evictions are primarily happening. And if that's what it's about, is to stop the evictions, about preserving our rent-controlled housing, that's what this measure is designed to do, and to kind of work around the edges and make sure that there aren't unintended consequences. And I'm sure Jay will disagree. I do want to take one thing, though, on the and Larry brought it up, too, this issue of, well, what about the revenues from this so-called tax, and why are they only going to the general fund? I think it's really important for the listeners to realize this is not a revenue measure. This wasn't put on the ballot for revenue. Look, in the affordable housing movement, we've spent
If you had your way, this would stop any of it from happening,
yes,
and there would be no revenue.
Yeah, as we like to say, in a perfect world, it wouldn't raise a single cent. It's not about revenue. It's about discouraging behavior that has no inherent value. It's not helping our housing stock. It's not helping folks who are either in their housing or want to get into housing. There is no value to this other than folks making profit off real estate. So our idea is we don't want the revenue to be programmed for affordable housing. That will make it sound very disingenuous. The board can do whatever it wants to do in programming whatever funds come in. But again, it's not a revenue measure. It's a discouragement of behavior.
Okay, let's now go to our callers. We have Rose from San Francisco on the line. Rose, welcome to City Visions.
Hello. I just have been inundated with No on G campaign flyers in my mail. And, of course, I have sent them several emails about this. I really, really feel that they are being really devious because the flyers have all this stuff, these scare tactics about how this will hurt homeowners, this will hurt seniors who own property as a nest egg for their retirement, et cetera, et cetera. And, of course, single-family homes are exempted, and also It only applies to property that's sold within 5 years of when it's purchased. And everyone seems to be ignoring that. And to me, that's the main thing, because homeowners and seniors who have a retirement nest egg, et cetera, legitimate property owners like that almost always have their property for a lot longer than 5 years before they sell it. So it wouldn't even apply to them. So anyway, that's all I have to say. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you for your call, Rose. Jay, can you respond to Rose?
Yeah, and we disagree with Rose. Obviously, she has a very strong opinion on this. But we want to get her last statement straight. The assessor recorder in 2013, the person in the city who's responsible for seeing how often property transfers from one tenant to another, said the average home turns over every 7 years. And this is a tax that will hit you if you sell within 5 years of ownership. And that's critical because, you know, while Rose's perception may be that property owners hold on to their property for decades and decades and decades, it's for the average homeowner, that's not a reality. The average home turns over every 7 years. And when you're an average home buyer, if you're a middle-class homeowner, and you come across a home that you would like to purchase after Prop G passes, the first question you're going to ask yourself is, am I going to be okay for the next 5 years? If I lose my job, if my mother falls sick in Ohio, if my spouse is no longer able to work, am I going to be able to afford this mortgage? And if not, am I going to be able to pay the Prop G tax if I have to sell within 5 years? And I think the answer for most middle-class homeowners is no, you're not going to be able to do that. But the people who can do that are real estate investors and the wealthy. Because a real estate investor looks at a home and looks at Prop G and says, yeah, I'll just hold this property for 5 years. I'll renovate more of it. I'll change the foundation. I'll change the paint job. And I'll hold it for 5 years. And when I sell it again, I'll double jack the price. And so really the wealthy and the real estate investors are the ones who aren't impacted about Prop G because they can afford it. They can afford to hold a property for 5 years. Well, middle class homeowners, we don't have the capital to make that decision.
Peter, I want to give you the opportunity to respond to Rose's comment and to Jay.
Sure. I think Rose hit the nail right on the head. And I'll just say that, you know, Jay, you know, continues to use language that I think is, you know, trying to misinform. This is not about homeowners. We just heard earlier, and Rose said it, single family homes are exempt. Condominiums are exempt. Tenancies in common are exempt. Any owner occupied units exempt. Single family homes with an in-law exempt. So we use the word homeowner because that makes us all feel personally invested and emotionally invested in this issue. Step back from that. This is about investors in rental property. And again, I'll just cite the one data point from the controller statement. On average, we're talking about 60 buildings a year. 60. So the vast, vast majority of San Franciscans out there, including Rose, this is not about you, Rose, and you know it. Thank you very much for your call.
Okay, let's go to Kevin in San Francisco. Kevin, welcome to City Visions.
Hello. I have a question because a single-family home with an in-law in the Bayview. I grew up in the Sunset area, and me and my wife just purchased this. You know, it was our only chance of staying in the city was buying something that's tenant-occupied. We got an agreement with the people in the in-law to move out with a certain sum, and then we're working on the agreement with the people upstairs, you know, because we're going to use it as a single-family home, obviously, but it does have an unwarranted, or as the realtor called it, but, you know, illegal in-law. So once we move into the house, after we remodel it, we're going to stay for at least 2 years. But, you know, ultimately our plan is to move back to the Sunset area. My mother is elderly. She may need us to move in with her at some point. And if we do, and the time's not right, then we would rent out the house because we couldn't afford to pay the mortgage and keep it vacant. So would I get hit with this tax? I talked to my attorney, you know, who's working with me on the buyout, and said, you know, it looks like from what he can tell that, you know, I'm going to be looked at if I moved in with my mother, if I, you know, if we moved back to the Sunset for some reason to be closer to my mother, and I put a tenant in it, that I would, and then I tried to sell it. You know, you can't get a tenant out once you put them in. You know, then I could be hit with this egregious tax. So I just don't understand really a lot about Prop G, but it scares somebody that, you know, saved up everything they can do to get into a home in San Francisco.
You know, I'd like to bring Larry Rosenthal from the Goldman Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley in. Larry, can you please give your best shot at answering Kevin's question?
Well, goodness, I feel for the supervisors as they face their choices in how to design this legislation. It's actually a very challenging piece of legislation to design. It's also a difficult piece of legislation to predict in terms of its impact. Clearly, Kevin is not an intruder. He's not a speculator. He's not doing anything that is kind of promoting some kind of evil in the real estate market. And it's within the realm of possibility that under those circumstances that he describes, that he would be inconvenienced by this tax. He would be forced into a longer hold period or an almost intolerable payment of this surtax. I think that, you know, if you're an attorney reviewing the situation, you're not only concerned about the impact, I think you're also concerned about whether this proposal will hold up on constitutional review. I, for one, thoroughly expect that there will be a lawsuit brought against Proposition G if it prevails at the polls, and that it may be overturned in the courts as a violation of the takings clause or violation of due process or equal protection. So I think that Proposition G is difficult to predict, and it's going to have a long row to hoe to become legal and effectual in San Francisco pending this litigation.
Okay, Kevin, we thank you very much for your call.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kevin. Let's now turn to Reed, also in San Francisco. Reed, welcome to City Visions.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Do you have a question for our panelists?
You know, I don't really have a question. I really have more of a comment, and that is that the increase in recent evictions has nothing to do with speculators coming in and buying properties. It has everything to do with the theoretically pro-tenant supervisors who ended or killed the condo conversion lottery, because previously, when the condo conversion lottery was in place, a major consideration was having a clean eviction history, especially an LSAC eviction, clean history on a property. And immediately, as soon as that new law went into effect, that effectively ended the condo conversion lottery, that's when we saw the increase of LS evictions in the city. It has nothing to do with speculators. And I think that it's really, if the backers of Prop G really want to end decrease, the number of evictions, what they should do is reinstate the lottery.
Peter, I'd like to give you a chance to respond to that.
That's an interesting theory, Reed. I mean, we've had an uptick in evictions over the last 3 years since the real estate market came back with a roar. You look at the data, I think it's been somewhere in the order of a 40% increase over the last 3 years in evictions. Yes, the reform on the condo conversion process went into effect about a year ago, and I don't think we've seen some response to that in the evictions, either up or down. That cycle has been happening on its own accord. So I don't quite see the connecting of the dots on the condo conversion reform itself. We had a backlog of, I think it was 2,500 and nearly 3,000 tenancies in common that were waiting to get through the condo conversion process. And the agreement was to allow all of those to be expedited over a phased process of 6 or 7 years to kind of clear out that pipeline. And that itself speaks to the kind of speculation activity that has been taking rental buildings, it's the same stock of buildings, and turning them into tenancies in common with the idea that somebody could get in the queue for condo conversion sometime over the next decade. So those kinds of market pressures of getting rental property, evicting tenants, flipping them for tenancies in common, and then hoping to get a condo conversion are still there with or without the reform to the condo conversion process.
Jay.
I think I would like to speak to Reed's larger point, right, which is I think something that everyone who deals with San Francisco housing points to, which is that we've come to a point in San Francisco housing where we have regulation upon regulation upon regulation. As a property owner, you're prohibited from this. You're going to be taxed for that. You're prohibited from doing this too quickly. You have to do this. You have to do this more speedily than you would want to. And the number of regulations we've put onto housing has warped the housing market, just like it's warped supply and demand, to make it to a point where housing's more expensive than it should be, and we've reduced supply lower than it has to be. And for us, Proposition G is another example of how we're putting things that create very random incentives and disincentives into the housing market upon other random disincentives and incentives in the housing market. And just like Larry said, it's incredibly impossible to predict. And we're just putting this forward to the voters and saying, on top of every other regulation that you're dealing with, try and guess how this will impact you.
Let's take a quick break, and then we will get to more of your calls. You're listening to City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KLW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight, we're discussing San Francisco's Prop G with our guests, Peter Cohen, co-director of the San Francisco Council of Community Housing Organizations and a supporter of Prop G, Jay Cheng, head of government affairs at the San Francisco Association of Realtors, which opposes Prop G, as well as Professor Larry Rosenthal of the University of California, Berkeley. We invite you, our listeners, to call in with your questions or comments. The number to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on the KALW website. Let's go back to the phones. We have Bora from San Francisco. Bora, welcome to City Visions.
Thank you. My question is to Peter. Let's imagine that I purchased a two-unit building this year. I'm not speculating. I'm not evicting anybody. Really, I just purchased it, and I'm hoping to rent it out. Somehow, I couldn't rent it out for circumstances out of my control. 6 months from now, I have to sell the building. Let's imagine that I bought it for $1 million, and I'm selling it for $1.01. I just want some clarification. The tax I need to pay, even though I haven't evicted anybody, and I have not speculated, I haven't done even any improvements on it, the tax I need to pay as an ordinary citizen is still $240,000 under this tax proposal. Is that true, Peter?
You're correct in that the surtax is on the entire sales amount of the property. You've obviously picked a scenario to try to demonstrate that there is a very, very nominal increase in value and therefore you have the tax. Yes, that kind of scenario that you just made up is true. Whether or not a property in San Francisco is going to sell for a penny over what it was purchased for is a good question. But also I'd be curious about the circumstances you bring up. Why would someone be buying a rental property with the intention of going into the landlord business and then immediately needing to sell that building in 6 months? It's a good question.
Because we just moved out of the city, let's imagine, or something happened and I had a death in my family and mm-hmm. I just don't want to be a landlord anymore. Yeah, I haven't made any improvements to the building. We haven't evicted anybody. So, you know, all the marketing materials that come to my home about yes on G are stop the eviction, say yes on G. I'm having a very hard time seeing a correlation between evictions and Proposition G. In the example I'm giving you, which is really the case in, you know, most of the people I know in San Francisco, people are trying to be honest business people and be in the business of being landlords. They're not trying to evict anybody, but everybody's scared very much about the Proposition G because of the example that I just gave you. In the example I gave you, if you sell it for a dime profit, you're still paying $240,000, even though you have nothing to do with evicting a single tenant. Is that true?
So that's a scenario, and I will tell you that the majority of what is happening is a very different scenario. So I appreciate your scenario pitch
but
to
the
us.
Answer to yeah. My question is that it is true that you will actually be paying $240,000 even though you have not evicted anybody.
If you resell a property in less than 5 years and you have a multi-unit property and you do not live in it, which is the other consideration, yes, there is a surtax
so really
on that
is,
property.
In the scenario that I just gave you, there really is no correlation, no relationship between evicting a tenant and paying the $240,000 of additional taxes. By the way, my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, this is in addition to the transfer tax.
Okay, Bora, thank you very much. One of the things I think Bora is getting at is a larger policy point that I know has been debated between your two sides, which is that this is a tax on the overall price of the house. And some people have said, okay, we're for this, but why not tax the profit? Why not tax the profit at 90%, say, because in a situation like Bora is describing, rare as it might be, you know, obviously in that case, someone could sell it for 10 cents less than the price, because my understanding is that if there is no profit, there is no tax. So let me just establish that.
Yep.
If you sell your house for less than you bought it for, there is no tax.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Absolutely correct.
Okay. Yeah. So now that we've established that, what about the first part of my question? Why go for the overall cost rather than taxing a percentage, even a very high percentage of the profit, if really the profit is what you're concerned about?
Right. That's a good question. And that would be a sensible approach if we could do it. State of California law prohibits imposing what would be considered an income tax at the local level. So if you're able to tax profit, that would be considered a tax that would be an income tax. Only state government can impose that. Therefore, at the local level, we are more constrained on the kind of taxation tools we use. So that's why the transfer tax that we have currently is on the full consideration of the property. The surtax for the speculation would just be in the same structure. It's on the consideration, the full value of the property. It'd be great to be able to tax profit. Can't do it at the local level.
Jay.
And this is just to say, what I understand from Peter saying is because state law hasn't allowed him to have a tax on profits, he's gone to a tax on the entire sales price. And whatever the intentions might be behind Prop G, we have to look at the actual policy at hand, which is a tax on the entire sales price of a home, which means, to Boris's point, you might lose money when you sell your home because of this tax on Prop G. And another point of Boris' scenario, which we think is actually very common and will happen, is that the tax is retroactive. It's a tax if you sell your home within 5 years after Prop G passes. But if you bought your home in 2013 and then you sell your home in 2016, you've owned your property for 3 years, which means that you will be taxed at the 18% level in Prop G, which means that we have literally thousands of homeowners who bought their home in the last 5 years not knowing Prop G was coming down the pike, having different plans for their homes, having different plans for their property, and now will be hit with a massive tax if they go through with the original intention of purchasing their home. And for us, that's incredibly unfair. And when Larry talks about constitutional takings and other things that might be ruled as a lack of due process, he's talking about that. He's talking about purchasing a home and not knowing you will be taxed on it because the tax went retroactive 5 years.
Peter, let me give you a chance to respond to the retroactive portion. Is that something that was debated, and why did you decide to go with retroactive?
Well, retroactive in the sense that the five-year holding period still applies. So if a property owner has, a rental property owner has a property and they resell it in less than 5 years, yeah, that would still apply. It's not retroactive in the sense that if you buy a home today, that somehow you're punished because that home was purchased originally previously. So it's the sale of the property in less than 5 years, starting from the time that this measure will take effect. And yes, it is retroactive in the sense that the five-year period counts going backwards.
And Peter, Prop G has tremendous political support across mm-hmm. the spectrum. Could you talk a little bit about who your key supporters are? And then, Jay, I'd like to ask you the same thing.
Sure. Most importantly, we have here in San Francisco, the San Francisco Democratic Party is supporting us, the San Francisco Labor Council, members of the Board of Supervisors, Supervisor David Chu, Eric Marr, John Avalos, David Campos, Jane Kim. We have former Supervisor Bevin Dufty. At the state level, Senator Mark Leno, who very importantly attempted to do Ellis reform just this last year and was stopped, unfortunately, by both the local and California realtors, Assemblymember Tom Amiano. And we have many, many of the Democratic clubs as well as a number of organizations. Sierra Club, we have the Tenants Union, obviously, and just a brief moment here, you know, hearts go out to Ted Gullickson, who just passed away recently from the Tenants Union. So we have a wide range of support in both local and state level.
Jay, who are your key supporters?
Sure. Supervisor Mark Farrow, Supervisor Katie Tang, Assessor Recorder Carmen Chu, former Assemblymember Fiona Ma. We have support from various Democratic clubs, Westside Chinese Democratic Club, Asian Pacific Democratic Club, Irish American Democratic Club, and major newspapers, SF Chronicle, the Bay Area Reporter, one of the oldest LGBT newspapers in the country, Sun Reporter, one of the oldest African American newspapers in the country, Tsingtao Daily, one of the major Chinese language newspapers across the city. And I just want to point out to the nature of our supporters. We're talking about Democratic clubs, and we're talking about supervisors and elected officials that have had a long history in San Francisco and come from being longtime residents and seen the city go up and down and are invested in its future. And we have all the supporters from major ethnic newspapers, communities of color, who know they've spent their entire life savings investing in this house, and that Prop G is taking away that opportunity, what they've really built their family on. And that's really why I think we have Tsingtao Daily, major Chinese and Asian American support, and Sun Reporter, major African American support.
You're listening to City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KLW San Francisco, and on the web at klw.org. Tonight, we're discussing Prop G with our guests, Peter Cohen, co-director of the San Francisco Council of Community Housing Organizations, Jay Cheng, head of government affairs at the San Francisco Association of Realtors, and Larry Rosenthal of the University of California, Berkeley. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email or text us at cityvisions@klw.org or post a comment on KALW's website. We're going to go back to the phones now. We have Nina in San Francisco. Nina, welcome to City Visions.
Hi. I wanted to talk about this how this legislation is being marketed to San Franciscans. As far as I know, it's being referred to as a revival of Supervisor Mills' anti-speculation tax from the 1970s, correct? Besides major differences in the legislation, like exempting in-law units and taxing the profit price versus the entire sales price of a unit of the property, Mills' legislation exempted seniors. Proponents of Prop G understand the dilemma seniors are in during today's uncertain time, but I don't understand why seniors themselves weren't exempt in this piece of legislation as they were during Milk's time.
Thank you for your question, Nina. Larry, I'm wondering if you could weigh in. How is this similar to and different from legislation that Harvey Milk put forward many years ago?
Well, David, it's actually quite fascinating. You know, this idea that Prop G has of heavily taxing land values, it's got a honorable San Francisco heritage. Not only did Supervisor Milk have this idea, and he was pushing it at the time of his assassination, more than 100 years previously, a young newspaperman in San Francisco named Henry George was deciding that land was unlike other things, that land actually belongs to everyone. It belongs to the people. It belongs to the public. And that heavily taxing it was the right thing to do to avoid depressions and recessions, and in fact to reverse income inequality and help the poor. Henry George wasn't, you know, some kind of wild-eyed progressive. His ideas as far as land taxation have been supported by Nobel Prize-winning economists Joseph Stiglitz and Paul Krugman. But it's important to point out that, at least for Supervisor Milk, the basis of the tax, like efforts elsewhere, like the longstanding land gains tax in Vermont that's been on the books for a long time, went after the gain. It didn't go after the price. I agree with Peter that the whole...
How was it able to go after the gain if that isn't... were the state laws different at that point where you actually could, a locality actually could go after the gain?
Well, California can go after the gain. And in fact, the proponents of Prop G could go to Sacramento and ask for a local gains tax to be permissible. It's something they may be forced to do if Proposition G doesn't win on November 4th. But when it's enacted at the state level, like in Vermont, land taxation is perfectly straightforward. But it's important, under the theories of Henry George, to distinguish between land, which is fixed and which belongs to the planet and belongs to everyone, versus the improvements, the building. And we can see that many landlords, many owners do invest treasure and time in improving properties, and that helps society generally. And the taxation of those improvements is on more wobbly ground as far as a policy justification than the land.
Okay, thanks, Larry. Let's now go to Billen in San Francisco. Billen, welcome to the program.
Hi there. I read in the New York Times the other day about Prop G, and I was shocked to see Supervisor Eric Marr, who I believe wrote the legislation, say that this won't stop speculation or flipping. What's the point, then, of passing this massive tax if it won't solve anything?
Peter, I'm not sure if you're aware of the article our listener is referring to, but let me give you an opportunity to respond.
No, I'm not familiar with the article, so maybe you could tell a little bit more about it. But there's not going to be, as folks like to say, one silver bullet solution to property speculation and flipping. Unfortunately, this is a time-tested way of making money in this country is through real estate property speculation. And we've gotten good things out of real estate investments. I mean, that's how cities are built. But unfortunately, it's also profiteering. And so it's not going to stop real estate speculation as we know it. But this particular type of behavior in this particular type of building, which has the very raw result of often evicting people, is something that we hope will be significantly discouraged.
And just to respond to that really quickly, because I do remember the New York Times article came out 2 weeks ago where Supervisor Eric Marr himself said, this won't stop speculation and flipping. And for us, that's very clear. Because if you're wealthy, and again, if you're a real estate investor, it's very easy to hold onto a property for 5 years. And Peter might be right. It will force real estate investors to hold onto property for 5 years, taking that supply out of the market. And when putting it back on the market after 5 years, double jacking the prices up on housing prices. And it's important to recognize slowing market vector doesn't mean you're slowing housing prices. It's going to create a more dramatic rise in housing prices as investors try and compensate for a 23% tax and a 5-year hold period while not doing anything to increase supply and not doing anything to help with demand. And so it's going to raise housing prices and not stop any speculation or flipping, as Supervisor Eric Martin mentioned.
Okay, let's now turn to Charlie from San Francisco. Charlie, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I hope you can hear me. I'm a rent-protected tenant in the Mission. I've been in my apartment for 10 years, so I'm pretty interested in not getting evicted. I'm also kind of a pre-market guy by philosophy. Peter, a couple times, says, I'm not a lawyer and I'm not a real specialist in mechanics of this stuff, but kind of glossed over, if my landlord were to sell my building to another landlord and that guy were to hold it for a short period of time, speculate a bunch and resell it in less than 5 years. My understanding was that us rent-protected tenants get passed along to the second intermediate landlord and then the third landlord, and the contract kind of goes with. How is it easier for that intermediate landlord or anybody to evict us? How does the speculative landlord have an easier time getting rid of us than my current landlord?
Charlie, you kind of lost me in the scenario there. So there's... You're in a building now.
What is the connection between the speculative resale of the property and the evictions? Why is it easy for the second and third landlord buyers to evict the tenant?
Right. So the value that's inherent in a building that's purchased that has rent-controlled tenants is to remove the tenants so you can realize the increased revenue return on those units. And thus, you see the temptation to evict. Now, evictions happen through Ellis or other types of ways where you're literally kicking someone out. And increasingly, they're happening through buyouts where people are simply negotiated out of their units. The estimates are anywhere from 3 to 4 buyout evictions happen for every one of our Ellis evictions or another form of eviction. So the opportunity in that kind of property investment is to buy your building, let's pretend it has 4 buildings, go through a process of trying to remove those tenants, whether it's by force or negotiation, and then to resell that building as available units for ownership. And then that gain through the different tenancy, the different occupant, is what makes the profit motive in the first place. If I'm just buying a building and you're staying in it, I'm not really going to realize much return because you have rent control protection, right? It only works if you're able to change the tenancy of the building.
Jay.
Okay. Well, it may be off topic, but what I'm personally interested in hearing more about is that Ellis Act and the ways that either landlord, negotiating me out and buying me out doesn't scare me so much. I'm okay to be bought out. Thanks. I'm not familiar with the Ellis Act abilities of either the current landlord to get rid of us all and increase realize a profit, or the new guy.
Sure.
And to respond to this, Charlie, you're absolutely right. Both landlords have equal ability to LS act evict you in either situation. And most importantly, Prop G doesn't change that scenario at all. Prop G, nowhere in the language of Proposition G, says the word eviction or tenant or speculation. It doesn't care if the speculative landlord evicted or did not evict you or kept you on or let you go or even if you were a tenant in there or not. So Proposition G has no connection to this. And so there's no incentive really built in to solve for any of the housing issues that Peter's talking about with Proposition G. And so there's going to be no impact on evictions or speculation when we discuss the policy.
So can I just wait one more thing, David?
Sure.
I mean, I think as Jay knows, you can't refer to evictions as a criteria for this because of state law preemption around Ellis. I mean, this is where we get into some of the minutia, Charlie, that the way the Ellis Act works at the state level is it preempts any local effort to try to overturn or get in the way of it. So Proposition G is not able to use as a criteria for the application of the surtax an eviction. It does by implication because this is the kind of building speculation activity where we see the Ellis Act and other types of evictions. But as Jay knows, you can't specifically build that into the ordinance.
Okay, I am going to go to one final call very quickly. Chris, welcome to City Visions.
Hey, I'm a long-term holding landlord in San Francisco, and I love this tax just like I like every other tax and every other creative thing that they can sell on a populist basis for the following reason. Every time they pass it, I get to raise my rents more. So, you know, it's a simple supply-demand problem from my perspective. We have to agree that this will reduce the supply of apartments, and if it does, how does that not increase the price, which is great for me. I mean, frankly, I love it, but for very selfish reasons.
Peter, I'm going to give you a chance to respond quickly to that, but then I want to give you each a chance to say some closing remarks. So if you could just give a quick response to Chris, because we're almost out of time here.
All right. Well, Chris, I'm not sure how your rents are increased by virtue of other people being evicted, but this doesn't change the supply of housing. It protects the supply of housing that we already have, which is our limited rent-controlled housing in San Francisco. We don't create any more rental housing and certainly no more rental housing with rent control. So this is protecting a limited supply.
Okay, I'm going to give you each about 30 seconds to make your final case to our listeners. Let's start with you, Peter. Why should voters vote yes on Prop G?
Well, Prop G allows us to stabilize our communities. This is a benefit for all of us as San Franciscans. We don't need to see this kind of churning in our neighborhoods, losing tenants, losing neighbors, having our homes, our neighborhoods used as a kind of real estate speculation opportunity. We're here because we believe in San Francisco and we're long-term invested in San Francisco, both in a monetary way and a human way. Prop G basically says, look, if you want to be a landlord, you want to be an investor, buy, hold, be part of building a community, not taking advantage of it. So we're asking you to vote Prop G and support San Franciscans, support tenants.
Jay Cheng, why do you recommend a no vote?
We recommend a no vote because this is simply a 14 to 24% tax on the entire sales price of a house. And you cannot increase the price of a house without increase the price of a housing market, making San Francisco even more unaffordable. And as Larry said, the professor from Berkeley, it's impossible to predict whether you do fall or not fall under Prop G. And so really every homeowner runs this risk of being assessed by Prop G. And so if Prop G does pass, our final message to everyone in San Francisco is find a good attorney. Because you have, a heck of a time trying to figure out whether Prop G applies to you or not, doesn't apply to you, or even how much you'll be taxed under the proposition.
Thank you both very much for joining us, as well as Larry Rosenthal from the University of California, Berkeley. We're listening to Peter Cohen, co-director of the San Francisco Council of Community Housing Organizations, and Jay Cheng, head of government affairs of the San Francisco Association of Realtors. That's City Visions for this evening. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was Bob Sommer. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb. Join my co-host Joseph Pache next week as he discusses another contentious ballot initiative, Proposition E, the soda tax. This is David Onick. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.